Welcome to STEM Spots, a weekly science review produced in cooperation with the Missouri State University Department of Physics, Astronomy, and Materials Science.
Hi, this is Dave Cornielsen, and you are listening to the webcast version of STEM Spots. With me in the studio today is Dr. Jonathan Dowell, who's a senior scientist at Los Alamos National Laboratory. Thanks for stopping by, Jonathan.
Thank you very much, Dave. It's good to be here.
So, Jonathan, you are an MSU alum, and talk a little bit about your experiences here at what is now MSU.
Yeah, it was a Southwest Missouri State University when I graduated in 1985. With a double major. I was a major in engineering physics, minor in mathematics, minor in computer science, and a minor in history, with just 2 hours shy of a percussion performance minor. My life at what then SMSU was incredible. What was made it so very nice was the ability to study in all the different disciplines, an opportunity that's not as available to other students at other universities. Having the range of disciplines available to all students really gave me a background that was a blessing. Some of the most fun that I had was in music, was performing in the pep band at the basketball games. Also performed in the football stadium at halftime, the football games. Was drum set performances in the swing choir and in the jazz bands. That was an excellent counterpoint to a background in physics.
Right, and you also got involved with some of the faculty here. Any ones that stand out in particular?
Certainly. My undergraduate advisors were Bob Thurman and Bruno Schmidt. Their wisdom, their expertise in teaching was such a blessing for me. To be at a university, first off, where the emphasis was on teaching as opposed to research at that time, meant that this faculty that were there were outstanding teachers. And so that was a real privilege to get to study with them. Now, a research program's a blessing as well, exposing the students to practical applications. And that's something that's only been available at MSU more recently. But studying with Dr. Thurman and Dr. Schmidt taught me a lot about how physics describes how the universe works.
Right. And so you got your degree, and it's 1985. You have this double degree, double major, and then you decided to do what exactly?
Well, there were a lot of opportunities. I wound up going directly to graduate research at the University of Virginia. I had turned down offers that I'd received from places like Harvard, MIT, and Caltech. University of Virginia was nice because of the size of the school and its multidisciplinary emphasis, continuing my engineering physics background. At the University of Virginia, I studied high-temperature thermometry at the Precision Measurements Laboratory with Professor George Gillies. We used laser-induced fluorescence of rare earth doped ceramics. So imagine the color pixels in an old Zenith television. You zap that with a laser and it would glow red. And the length of time that it would glow would change as a function of temperature. So we use that to build thermometers. Taking how the world works and building engineering tools from them, that's engineering.
Yeah, physics. That is interesting. What kind of temperatures could you measure up to with thermometers like that?
Ceramic thermometers will work up to the melting points of the ceramics, which may be 1,000 degrees Celsius.
Wow. So did that end up having practical applications, or was it just the training you got you were able to take that when you went further on?
There were two paths the research was pursuing. One was to develop an atomic standard for thermometry. The other was to solve a problem for the U.S. Air Force. They wanted to measure the temperatures of the fan blades in their operating jet engines, and the pyrometric thermometers at the time would instead measure the burning jet fuel in front of the fan blades. These ceramic thermometers would bond directly to the fan blade and allow you to measure the temperature of the fan blade directly.
Interesting. So you get a PhD at University of Virginia, and that experience allows you to move forward from that. And somehow you work your way circuitously, presumably depending on postdocs and so forth and so on, to a place like Los Alamos National Lab. Now, was that a dream? Was it accidental? How did that all happen?
Oh, everything happens by chance and opportunity. The work that I had done at the University of Virginia had been sponsored by or funded by the Department of Energy through the National Laboratory in Los Alamos that had the contract with the U.S. Air Force. And so I migrated directly from UVA to Los Alamos to continue that research in high-temperature thermometry. But once there, the wheels came off, and within a year, I was doing completely different research, taking advantage of all the different investigations of problems of interest to our Uncle Sam.
Now, when you're at a place like that, I was always under the impression that it was very prescribed. You're in the theoretical branch, or you're over here, and you're doing this very constrained project for so-and-so because it's a nuclear-related research or something like that. But to hear you tell it, there's a lot more room for, let's call it, entrepreneurship than I would have thought possible. Talk about how that works exactly.
Well, it's a consequence of how the government is organized, or some would say failed to be organized. You have different projects, say the Department of Defense, the Department of Agriculture, that have an engineering problem that needs solved. They don't know how to solve the problem. That's not their expertise. So then they will approach the National Laboratory and say, hey, how on earth could you solve this? And with all of those customers beating a path to the door of the National Laboratory, there's all those opportunities for innovation. So it's kind of an ability to pick and choose which problems in which I was most interested, where I have some inspiration to help one of those customers solve a problem of importance to them.
Right. Now, you're around all these people. What's it like? So as a practicing physicist myself, certainly when I was younger, I read all the various kinds of biographies and histories of the labs and other sorts of things, and it just seemed not exactly romantic, but pretty amazing. So you're around all these people. It's got to be quite almost inspiring in a way, perhaps. A lot of very, very bright people. It must have been stimulating, to say the least.
There are a few, and like any place that you'd work, it's a mix of cultures. There's a famous joke of a congressman visiting the National Laboratory and getting a tour of the 43 square miles. And the congressman at one point asked the director, "Director, how many people work at the National Laboratory?" The director replies, "Oh, about half."
Yeah, that's pretty funny.
It's all across the board. There are, you know, Nobel Prize winning scientists, and then there are people who are just putting in the time doing the work. It's like any place where you would go to work. They're just different personalities. And so you lock yourself in with the groups that are most inspirational to you and take advantage of those opportunities.
So would you say that you learned a tremendous amount since you've been there?
Oh, my goodness. I've learned so much, and there's so much left to be learned. It's humbling how little a person with a bachelor's degree, what they think they know versus what they are able to know. It's really humbling to realize how much more there is to be learned. But it's so essential to have that jumping off point with a bachelor's degree from a school like MSU.
Certainly. And then when you get your PhD, you realize that there's more that you don't know than you do know, certainly. At least for me, that's always been the case.
If you don't realize how much more there is to be learned, you're simply not paying attention. To this very day, till the end of my life, there will be more to be learned.
Right. So now you're involved in a particular kind of project that's been going on for a little while. You're stopping by today to talk about that a little bit. How did you get into that, and what is it exactly?
Well, the new problem that I'm helping to solve is building directional radiation detectors. This is a problem that was inspired by old, dirty glove boxes. We were doing glove box sanitization. A glove box is a chamber in which people do work with hazardous materials, such as radioactive materials. And over time, the box simply gets dirty. And after a while, you want to throw it away. You can't just simply dump it in the trash. You have to wash it first. So my idea was, rather than washing it and washing it over again, if you could tell where it was most dirty and concentrate the effort of cleaning in those corners, you would minimize waste or reduce the number of Brillo pads and bottles of Windex needed to clean an old dirty glove box, and therefore achieve an environmental function as well as a scientific purpose of saying, where is this radioactive material? So I build radiation detectors that were kind of like TV antennas. When you point them at a radioactive source, you get a brighter signal. And when you look away, the signal strength goes down. That allows you, just like pointing a TV antenna, to tell where the source of this radiation is coming from.
Did that, so you hear about inspiration. Was this a eureka moment for you, or what, or was it, did it build up over time?
that was a eureka moment. It happened on a Tuesday morning where I wasn't aware that people were facing this problem of needing to sanitize old dirty glove boxes. And I thought, I know my background in electrical engineering. If I had something that worked like an antenna, I could solve the problem this way. The folks that were doing the research with a background in nuclear engineering, unaware of how TV antennas worked, didn't have the background necessary to harness that, transfer that technique from another discipline into what they were doing.
So one of your radiation detectors, this directional in nature, it's got a detector piece and it's got a piece that helps it become, let's call it directional. So you've got people working on it from all angles. So which part of it are you most interested in? Are you most interested in the design of the overall? You must be the overall designer. But do you have people working on these that are the detector experts and then the component experts? How is that team put together?
Interesting question. Yeah, I'm the sole inventor. My name's alone on the patent that was issued last September. But I work with a team that includes industrial partners. We have three different companies that have contributed, one in Virginia, one in Arizona, one in Oregon, who've developed, individual components that put all together, allow these detectors to work.
That's interesting. So it's also, you and I have discussed, there's some interesting materials problems related to this. What kinds of things are you looking for? You're looking for certain kinds of materials, and how hard is it to find the ones you need to find?
Well, it's down in the engineering weeds, but it's kind of like if you can imagine building sunglasses for a radiation detector. When you go out in the bright sun, you wear sunglasses to cut down on the sunlight that's getting into your eyeballs. We need a similar material, but something that works with radiation. We want to block some, need not block all, but at least some of the radiation coming from space into the detector. So material very much like sunglasses, but for radiation. The kinds of radiation that we need to block include neutrons, which are non-charged particles inside of nuclei, and gamma rays, which are very, very high energy photons. If you can imagine purple to ultraviolet to ultra, ultra, ultraviolet, those are gamma rays. So we need materials that can block, like sunglasses, will block neutrons and gamma rays. Those are materials science problems, and the characteristics of different materials make them more or less effective at attenuating those kinds of radiation.
So you came up with this idea, and then you had to go out and find these partners, or were the partners just waiting and they were easy to find?
It's such a rich economy. There are marvels of technologies available in industry, and it's sort of picking up a phone book, and if you're anyone old enough to remember actual phone books rather than searching on Google. So you go to the yellow pages and find the industries that are already doing similar work. And so you call them up and say, hey, here's for what I'm looking. What bright ideas do you have? And then piece all of these techniques together. We found one company that had in Oklahoma that had developed a material that was effective at blocking neutrons. We found another company in Indiana that had some materials capable of blocking gamma rays. And we bought those materials or processed them and took the materials to our industrial partner in Arizona, built the detectors there.
Right. So you're still working at Los Alamos and you plan on trying to put these out into the field. What's the ultimate goal? Find partners where they actually need these in the field?
Well, the National Laboratory's role is to develop the technology, less so to commercialize it. Private businesses are much more effective at building finished products, shrunk wrap and plastic on store shelves waiting for customers to harness them. So my next step will be technology transfer, to take my invention and then putting it in the hands of a U.S. industry that would like to take that the last mile and deliver it to a market. Those markets could include not only our Uncle Sam, but energy industries, environmental organizations, anyone doing surveys of radioactive materials.
So now everything you've talked about shows how rich a career can be and how varied it can be when you have a degree in physics and math and almost music and history and so forth and so on. So talk about students today. Here you have all these students. They're going through your experience, but it's 30-something years later. And are there going to still be the wealth of opportunities at places that are as inspiring and have as much going on as places like Los Alamos?
There will always be opportunities, limited only by the imagination of the students. Los Alamos particularly has an interesting opportunity on the horizon. This October, the contract will change. And so much of our staff is, shall we say, aging, that they will be tempted to take their retirement benefits and take their marbles and go. Those will create vacancies ripe for new students to come in and fill, not only to learn what has already been done, what has been known in the rich history of a place like Los Alamos, but also to tackle the next generations of opportunities from our customers in the U.S. government and elsewhere in U.S. industry.
Right. Well, that's always nice to hear because I know it's true, but it's good to hear from other people. Also, some people out there in the world don't realize exactly the opportunities that STEM degrees do afford. Jonathan, I really appreciate you stopping by and talking to us today.
Dave, thank you for your time.
And once again, this is Dave Corneosen for STEM Spots and the webcast version signing off.
STEM Spots is available online at ksmu.org.